Good Vibrations.
Welcome to this second episode in a Good Vibrations expose into what may well be yet another military-grade social engineering psyop. In this case, the one known as the Second Summer of Love, in the words of the mainstream media of the time. This is the birth of the UK acid house rave scene, which paved the way for 90s dance music and clubbing culture and the electronic dance music phenomenon that would go on to sweep the rest of the world. Joining me for this conversation are Dom and Chris of Sheep Farm Studios and also Matt Sergiu of the Occult Beatles and Conspiro Media sites. In episode 1, we got into the traditional account of how this whole scene got started and considered some of those early DJs and clubs and also, of course, the drugs, MDMA, ecstasy. More of that in this episode, plus we also get into the darker, sinister side of the smiley yellow face, as well as some of the other symbolism attached to that scene. Let's go with episode 2.
I feel sorry for the kids who are out there, who are drug-free, who like acid house, or whatever you call it, house, whatever, and they like to dance, wave their hands in the air, and their parents thinking, God almighty, are my kids on drugs? And that is only from a certain newspaper.
What would you say to reassure parents who are worried about letting their kids go out at night now?
Well, if you brought your children up properly, and you love your children, and you know your children, you'll know if they take drugs or not. You don't need acid house to make them take drugs.
Matt, you were just talking there about how Chicago House came along in 1986, just in time for these four young lads to go to Ibiza and the birth of rave culture and all this sort of stuff. So very serendipitous time in there. So I've also got a quote here from Pete Tong and Paul Oakenfold when they were writing an article for Mixmag in 1988 called The Balearic Beat Story. So Oakenfold and Tong wrote, "The emergence of this movement in London has coincided quite conveniently with the ever-increasing popularity of acid house. Indeed, house music does provide a large proportion of the soundtrack at new London clubs, considered to be the pioneers of the new scene. It was something that a year later would be massive, thanks to what's been called the Second Summer of Love. So, serendipity everywhere you look."
Also, I noticed that in 88, 89, and again, I can say this with some authority because I was of the age. So I was like young and I was a teenager and I was ripe for all this stuff. A lot of my friends and myself included, you know, I seem to recall that 1988, 89, you certainly saw this revisiting of the 60s in culture, in youth culture, in contemporary youth culture of the time. Flared trousers. I mean, up until everyone started wearing bell bottoms. I mean, up until 1988, 89, I remember as a kid, if you wore bell bottom jeans in England in the 1980s before then, you were bullied at school. You know, you had to wear like drain pipes, you know, stay press. What were they called? Those trousers are really thin.
Stay press, yeah.
Yeah. If you wore bell bottoms, you were laughed at. You were absolutely annihilated. People started to grow their hair long. I mean,
also, Matt, something that just dawned on me, actually, if you remember before the Second Summer of Love, the style before that in the early 80s was the 50s, because it was Pasadena's rock and roll made a comeback. A lot of Motown made a comeback. You had those 501 ads, 501s.
Yeah, the Levi's. Thing,
the straight leg 501s.
And the bomber jackets, the black bomber jackets.
Yeah. Leather jackets. Because they were quite unusual at the time. When 501s came back, when they made a big thing, they made all those adverts. They all revolved around the 50s advertising and music, didn't they?
And you had Nick Kamen.
Nick Kamen, with his boxer shorts on.
Yeah, and the 50s haircut.
Motown made a massive comeback. And then when that died off, it was literally instantly replaced by a new 60s, like you said, people wearing flared jeans and
growing their hair long. I mean, no one had long hair in the 80s up until 1988, 89. Before then, it was short hair.
Well, apart from mullets,
Yeah. I'm not even going to class that. That's not even a style, is it? That's just, I don't know what that is.
did you use the programming to move from the 50s to the 60s again?
Yeah, I never thought of that, yeah.
I didn't, I just redonned them in out.
And I remember a lot of my friends at the time, I didn't really get into this, but they started getting a fixation on VW Beatles.
Yeah, that was another... Yeah.
That was another Beastie Boys, wasn't it? The Beastie Boys.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Wearing the VWs around the neck.
Yeah. That's right. But there was all these like VW Beetle like enthusiasts another of my age throwback. Group.
Yeah. Yeah,
another 60s throwback. So.
Also, that's a defining line, isn't it, from having the 50s sort of fashions and songs and that. I noticed a lot of songs came out as well. A lot of old soul songs, Sam Cooke and things like that in the
using
the
60s.
Using adverts to market them, yeah.
But the 50s were the last nuclear family type period. Before they destroyed it in the 60s.
And they
quite a defining line again in the 80s, isn't it?
Rehashed it in the 80s, do it again.
And in the late 80s also, you saw the re-emergence of the popularity amongst the young, I should say, of the Beatles. I mean, I don't know. I didn't really grow up in the 70s to know if the 70s kids really dug the Beatles. But when I look back at the 70s from an outsider's point of view, I see punk, I see very anti-Beatles movements going on, like punk and new wave and stuff like that. But certainly in the 80s, I remember people of my age got into the Beatles and the Stones and Jimi Hendrix. They began to become, quote unquote, trendy again. You know, and you had bands like the Stone Roses and the Charlatans and who began to have that kind of 60s psychedelic feel to their music with a 90s vibe to it. Happy Mondays, again, they kind of had a 60s feel to some of their tracks. It was a swaggering kind of 90s indie music kind of groove, but it had a 60s vibe to it, you know. So there was a lot of that going on. And I can vouch for that because I was there at the time and I experienced it, you know. And certainly acid, I never took it, but a lot of my friends started taking LSD about that time as well. I can remember sitting in rooms with them while they were all... I'd be the only straight one in there and I'd be sitting there kind of just getting off on the music without needing it. And they were all tripping their nuts off, you know.
I'll admit, I dabbled in acid when I was a youngster.
I was going to say that we were all straight, but apart from Chris.
I took it once, laughed for about 25 hours, and never took it again.
I had some mushrooms once and it tasted bloody awful. I drank it and it just tasted god awful. And I just never did it again. It was just... Bleh.
Reading a Guardian headline here, I don't know if you can let me share the screen there, Mark. And it says, about the Summer of Love, in 1988, the headline is, "It changed lives and opened minds," which I suppose that is what they want us to, wanted to do, isn't it? They wanted to change lives and open people's minds. Now, whatever that means, that...
Well, open minds to let stuff into it, put stuff into it.
Yeah, to make them more susceptible to whatever they wanted them to be. That is mind control, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I want to get into some of the symbolism that was used in those early Acid House days, the obvious one being the yellow smiley face.
Quite surprising that one you... I found it surprising when you... Well, I looked at that record earlier, Matt, but not only is it the smiley face, but it's literally the Watchman version.
Yeah, so I'm wearing like a modern, this is a sort of Convid era version of the Acid House symbolism from back in the day. That's the new normal. And here's that original Bomb the Bass sleeve, and it's got that Watchmen logo on it. And this brings up a very interesting aspect to the story, which is that when you listen to those early Acid House records using the Roland 303 synth, was it? Is that the one?
I think so, yeah.
TB 303 or something like that.
Yeah, those burbling, electronic, sort of squelching, squelchy sounds. Yeah, very distinctive to the Acid House scene. Those early records were not happy records. That came later. All the euphoric trance and the hands in the air, happy sort of pill-popping tunes, you know, came in the 90s, really. But in 88, 87, the records that were coming out of London were all using this squelching sort of synth sound, and they weren't happy. A lot of them were very dark, and a lot of the symbolism was very dark as well. This is where we get into the use of the smiley, which comes out of the Watchmen graphic novel series, and this is Chris's territory here. So tell us a bit more about the origins of that smiley yellow face, Chris, and why would it have been adopted as a motif for this scene, I wonder?
Well, interestingly, I was a big Watchmen fan when I was growing up. But what was the name of that guy, Dom, who got thrown out the window of the MK Ultra?
Frank Olson.
Frank Olson. When me and Don were doing one of our Huxley ones on this, I realised that, so you've got the smiley face, and in the comic book, The Watchman, it's got a splat of blood over it, and it's signifying 2 minutes to midnight, basically. So the end of the world is nigh kind of thing. But in the first few pages of the book, the comedian, who's the, I don't know if anyone's seen the film, he gets thrown out of a window, which is what happened to Frank Olson. Or they said he jumped out of a window off his napper on LSD. But his family are still trying to sue the American government for that. But in the comic book, he falls out the window, and that's where you get the smiley face with a blood splat on it. So it lands on the pavement, and there's a blood splat pointing at basically 5 to 12, end of the world is nigh kind of nuclear time clock. But it's just interesting that starts with a guy getting thrown out of a window.
And they're utilising LSD in both.
Well, utilising smiley face, basically. Yeah. I mean, if you link them two together, then you got this guy. And when just before we came on, I was just flicking through the comic book. And also, as he's getting thrown through the window, you've got the shattered glass all around his head. Yeah, I can show it. I mean, it's guesswork, and maybe it's reaching, but it's...
It's always coincidental, Chris.
is it signifying? So that's him getting thrown through the window there. Can you see that? And then that you can see his badge there. That's what starts off the smiley face, and that's the logo of the Watchman. But then there's a closer picture there of him, and he's got the smiley face and the symbolism. He's got the shattered glass all around his head, and it's quite distinctive shattered kind of glass, that, isn't it? It's not just it's splintered like an MKUltra mind controlled, yeah. And then he's got the badge on there as well. Just interesting. Are they depicting what happened to Olson right there? You know, this guy goes into his room, beats him up, throws him out of a window.
Again, the whole smiley story has the element of accidental happening. It was devised in 1963. So it was drawn in 1963 by a guy called Harvey Ross Ball. And he was paid $45. And he never copyrighted it. And a French guy copyrighted it in the 70s. And that company now turns over something like $550 million a year in licensing fees. Hmm. And it's being used in other things like Nirvana's logo.
Nirvana's logo, if you remember, guys, with the crosses over his eyes, his tongue hanging out, and he died. And he's got a dint. He's actually got a dint in its head as well. And he apparently shot himself in the head. And then he's used in the Forrest Gump film as well, if you remember, when he puts the... wipes his face, and he's basically making out for his Gump invented the smiley face look.
Another time I was running along, somebody who had lost all his money in the t-shirt business, and he wanted to put my face on a t-shirt, but he couldn't draw that well, and he didn't have a camera.
Here, use this one. Nobody likes that color anyway.
Have a nice day. Well, some years later, I found out that man did come up with an idea for a T-shirt. He made a lot of money off of it.
And Utopia, you know, the movie Utopia, the bag that he was carrying around with all his weapons in when he was,
is that the one,
was killing people. Yeah.
Yeah, and the basic story of that is where they create an illness, then drug everybody.
Yeah. They jab everybody. Yeah.
Sounds familiar. Also, the modern emoji that everyone uses is the same colour yellow as well.
That distinctive Simpsons yellow, I suppose you call it.
And you've got the Minions.
With their one eye.
One eye. Yeah.
Do you know, I watched the Minions, just as a very quick side note. I watched it recently. And you know, they talk gibberish. After hearing this, I Googled what they talk, and it's just gibberish made up. And one of them shouts out Divock in one of the films.
Oh, for real?
Not Divock, but, you know, yeah. I think it was Divock or Corona, one or the other, and it was around that time.
Corona.
When it came out. Yeah, he shouts it out. I did tell you, didn't I, at the time. Yeah.
So burbling mindlessly as if they'd just popped a bunch of pills.
Yeah.
Or maybe had the arm spear.
Yeah.
Or had the arm spear, yeah. 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 One of the two.
It's a shame in one way. Okay, you're not seeing my face, but that's not the shame. But it's a shame it's not vision, because I do have a record.
You haven't got a yellow smiley face, have you, Matt?
I've got a record sleeve with a record with a smiley face on it, and it's by West Bam, Monkey Say, Monkey Do. Do you remember that track? I think it was early 90s. It was like a huge club track. So I'll have to send a scan over it so it can be added into the post-production. But it's got a sticker on it of a smiley, and it's got an eye patch, so it's only showing one eye, and it's got a Hitler moustache. So, yeah, that's
another. I remember that. That rings a bell, that does, yeah.
There's also the smiley face killings. You guys familiar with that story?
Yeah. Is that true?
Well, this comes from, or should I say, one guy that's really researched this in a major way is William Ramsey. William Ramsey Investigates. He's done a whole bunch of podcasts on this. I've got an excerpt here from what I wrote about it in Musical Truth 2. So over the past 20 years, and this was in 2018, so goes back to the late 90s, more than 50 young men have been abducted and murdered in more than 25 of the US states. The crimes have come to be labelled as the smiley face killings. Their geographical spread suggests they're the work of a coordinated group rather than one crazed individual. The victims have all been adult males of college age, usually athletic and high academic achievers. They're usually last seen on their way home from drinking at bars or parties. Their bodies turn up sometimes weeks or months after they disappear, immersed in water, primarily rivers, creeks, or lakes. Smiley face emblems appear in the vicinity of the bodies, usually daubed onto trees or walls in paint. In the case of one victim, a smiley face appeared out of nowhere on his tombstone. And these killings have also been happening in the UK. It's not just an American thing, which totally destroys the idea that it's some crazed lunatic doing it all, because it's been happening on British shores as well. I think there's been a concentration of them in the Manchester area, but it's been all over the UK. Smiley faces appearing in the vicinity of these murders as well, and the bodies, again, always turning up in water. So this does paint the smiley face in a rather more sinister light, doesn't it?
It also reminds me of the clown face. John Wayne Gacy, that type of thing as well, and the clown masks, if you like, where something's happy, but in reality there's a darkness behind it.
That what you were saying there, Matt, reminds me of the missing 411 David Pilates stuff, especially the immersion of water. What a strange story.
Very ritualistic.
Mm.
Very ritualistic. Also, I mentioned in that same book a US police drama called The Mentalist, which ran from 2008 to 2015, and it had a plotline involving a serial killer named Red John, whose calling card was to leave a smiley face design at the scene of each of his murders. It also gets a rendering in the British TV series Sherlock, starring Benedict Cumberbatch. In the first episode, Holmes gets a can of yellow paint found at a crime scene and uses it to spray a smiley face on his living room wall. And it appears in every subsequent episode. So there's some more.
How strange. Why this smiley face kept alive all this time?
Just a side note, Benedict Cumberbatch played Alan Turing, who was the Enigma Code guy.
Imitation
and
game.
They were actually related.
Cousins.
A royal bloodline.
Yeah, that's right.
Alan
surprise,
Turing.
Surprise.
Yeah, yeah. I think Alan Turing's bloodline goes back to King John. Benedict Cumberbatch's related to him. What a shock.
Yeah, absolutely shocked by that, yeah.
Some of the early Acid House flyers that came out sort of in 88, 89 had a lot of suspect symbolism as well. So besides the smiley yellow face, there was a lot of Masonic imagery, pyramids and squares and compasses. There was Egyptian sort of mystery school stuff. There were lots of UFO themes, UFO, alien, mothership ideas, planetary convergences and things like this, or metaphysical, supernatural sort of mystery school stuff on early Acid House flyers. There's collections of them that you can see online. So very early on, you had all this symbolism getting put into the subliminal minds of the kids that were getting into this stuff, augmented by the drugs that they were taking to help absorb the symbolism more, I guess. And then the electronic music with whatever that was doing with all the frequencies and the pitch and all this. So it was quite a cocktail of influences that the likes of us were soaking up in those times.
People off the napper, if you like, and staring at these flyers. Because I remember, Matt, you used to hand them out as you left the nightclubs, didn't they? You'd get piles of them, wouldn't you? And people used to collect them. Yeah. So you'd be, I suppose, people driving home in the car, still getting driven home, should I say. I was still, you know, fresh from this club, glaring at this powerful imagery. They could be soaking anything in, couldn't they?
Yeah, it all goes hand in hand, the visuals. The parties got bigger, so Acid House parties started off very small and humble. It was like a cottage industry, like Danny Rampling's Shum was only, I don't know, less than 100 people, I think. Very small parties. But as you got into 89 and then into the 90s, they got bigger in scale. And that's when you started to get really the visuals. You'd have all these light shows and lasers and all these images flashed up for split seconds at a time, straight in the subconscious mind. So there must have been a lot of programming going on there. I think in the future, or in the subsequent conversations that we have, we should talk about how the 80s gave way to the 90s, and we had the Superclub era, and the likes of Ministry of Sound and Gatecrasher, and all these brands came on the scene, Cream and all this. We'll do that in the next one. We'll sort of stick to the late 80s in this one, but definitely all this stuff must have been having an effect in a major way.
Well, when I think of the strobe lighting, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, you can own, I think, I don't know if it's law or if it's a regulation in the UK, but these days you are not allowed to leave a strobe light on in a club after a certain amount of seconds. You can only leave it on for something like 20 seconds or something. I'm not sure. I seem to recall that from my days as a DJ, that these days you cannot leave a strobe light on for too long. But back in the day, you'd go to an underground dance gig, you know, back in the late 80s, the era we're talking about now, and the strobe was on all night, you know. It never, and strobe lights, it has been said, do cause epileptic fits, and that's why they brought in this regulation, I think, if I'm not mistaken. It's to alleviate that, basically, to stop people having fits in the middle of the middle of a club. But yeah, I just wonder what the effect of a strobe light has on someone who's taken a hallucinogen. You know, whether it's LSD or whether it's ecstasy or whether it's something else completely that's hammering away in your brain. What sort of effect is the drug having whilst you're dancing to this frenetic music and the strobe lighting as well? I don't know. That's just something I've always wondered.
I mean, even films and video games have a warning about strobe effects.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Well, and another thing as well is obviously the music. You were mentioning the Roland... Hello, Roland. 303.
Roland.
Yeah, and that was a Roland Corporation. So you're talking of a big corporation. I was looking up the guy, a Japanese guy, invented all these sounds that were used in the Chicago house scene. And you look through all the drum beats and all the sounds were initially invented by the Roland Corporation. And he was a Japanese guy whose parents had died, I think, during World War II. Who just happened to come up with all these synthesizers and things like that were then used in the 80s. So I might do a bit of digging around that, to be honest with you.
I think that the official narrative is, and I might be wrong, but I seem to recall reading somewhere that these were like disused. They were like samplers. These were like, they were rejects basically in secondhand stores. Happened by chance. I can't remember where I read about this. I think it might have been Derek May, the producer Derek May from back in the day, you know, one of the pioneers of the sort of the electric dance.
Yeah, Detroit techno.
Yeah, it's Detroit techno. I think it was him in an interview. He said that these machines, these devices were basically secondhand rejects. And so they picked these up dirt cheap and began to play around with these squelchy sounds. And yeah, and the rest is history, as they say. But yeah, again, is that the official narrative? Another of those, oh, happen by chance kind of, you know, stories that they like us to believe, you know, that, oh, look, oh, by coincidence, we just happened to run across these machines and, oh, look, and we managed to make a worldwide...
I'm sure a lot of the DJs thought it did happen organically. This is the clever element of all this. I'm sure a lot of the people, maybe in the Rolling Stones, you only need one person, like, say, Mick Jagger in the Rolling Stones, who's on the inside. Every other member might not be on the inside, but they're not going to question things because they're worth $100 million or whatever.
And Brian Jones, one of the original Stone members, comes from Cheltenham.
Yeah, home of GCHQ.
Yeah, GCHQ, Cheltenham. So, yeah. I won't mention that too much because that's going off into a completely different tangent. But yeah.
But it's all part of it because the technologies that are, they can't capture everybody, as probably we prove. But the people who are susceptible to it, who they can mind control into believing it's organic, they're your ideal Manchurian candidate. So if you imagine a DJ or a pop singer as a Manchurian candidate, they don't all have to be carrying sniper rifles, do they, to deliver the message?
Yeah. You just have to make them believe.
Yes.
So the same way that the kids in the late 80s bought into the scene because they thought it was something for them, it spoke to their generation, just the same way as the hippies in the 60s thought, this is our scene, this belongs to us. So too many of the DJs, as you say, probably went along with it and thought, this is great, I'm going to jump on this gravy train and start embracing this new music and make that money. And as you said, Dom, they're not necessarily on the inside. They just don't have full knowledge of what the agenda is. They just get swept along with it. And that is the genius of these things.
Just like the SEALs who were clapping on the doorsteps in 2020, banging pots and pans. They don't know what was going on, but they went along with it because the controllers know that a certain amount of people are just going to go along with it, aren't they?
That's right.
One thing stands out as well is that every scene has its drug of choice, doesn't it? There are drugs that cross over, but like the 1960s LSD had weed and things like that. The Northern Soul scene had uppers. They were using all these dietary pills.
Ketamines.
A lot of them were breaking. Yeah, ketamine and things like this, uppers. I think the Soul scene had a lot of coke and things like that. Hip-hop scene,
80s, crack. 80s, 80s I would say was coke, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the Soul scene, probably that type of scene, Scarface came out, and the hip-hop scene, crack. The grunge, heroin.
And they almost filter it out at the end of the decade and then bring in the new one just as a bit like 1989, the decade just ending. Filter out the old stuff and bring in the new one.
But most of this stuff's been around for years, like MDMA. It was invented by Merck.
Yeah.
In 1912.
1912.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was the guy that one of the Merck members was working with Frank Olson and Sidney Gottlieb. Gottlieb, I better pronounce that right.
Are you saying that pharmaceutical company was dodgy for?
Well,
I saw on Wikipedia 21 million people, it said, used ecstasy in 2016 between the ages of 15 and 64, not 0.3% of the world's population.
I wonder how they come up with such a figure. How do they collate that figure?
It's exactly what I thought. And if you look between the ages of 15 and 64, why are them ages? And you've got a 6 and an 11.
Yeah, this is something I often get from people of our sort of generation. They'll say, I went to early acid house raves, popped ecstasy, I had a great time. It opened my mind, it expanded my consciousness, it brought compassion and empathy. What's so bad about that? And my answer is always, well, if that kind of experience is happening on your own terms and it's a free will decision that you've made, then it can be a positive thing in that way. But if it's happening on somebody else's terms, particularly the terms of social engineers working for military intelligence outfits, I think we can conclude that they don't have your best interests at heart. So it's the circumstances in which this stuff gets used. And also, I wonder whether they create scenes, such as the dance music scene, with the deliberate intention of sending it crashing down sometime into the future. So they whip everyone up into euphoria, like they did with the 90s dance scene and the club culture and stuff, knowing that when this generation reaches middle age, the sort of age we're at now, it becomes so devastating to them that they're not living through that anymore, that it becomes absolutely crushing. And you have all these nostalgic pinings for when you were happy in your youth, and now you've lost all of that because that scene is gone. And that's all part of it.
You've got a whole group of people, not us, but people who are still pining back for that period of time. And I think there's a name for them, actually. They call them graves, ravers, graves, granddads who rave still.
Right.
Yeah. We shouldn't talk about that. But I think you could be right there, Mark. And also you've got say it's one out of, I don't know, making it up, but one out of 20 people, it has quite a bad effect, long term effect on the health as well. Everyone knows that. You know, there's that
also, Chris. Going back to what you were saying, Mark, about the people who had a great time. You know, I'm sure the problem with what the controllers have, they can only control a certain amount of it. There's always a parameter that a part of it that they can't control, a percentage, as we found out in 2020. There's always a percentage of us that are going to say, no, fuck you. And likewise with the rave scene, I'm sure some of us came out with it more open-minded, more the realization that everything isn't what we think it is, etc. But we also know a lot of people that were out there, the majority of people, of a lot of my friends, are still closed books, even more so now than they were in the 1980s, 1990s. So it's actually sent them the opposite way.
Do you wonder also whether our generation was being primed to go along with the nonsense of the last 3 years, because they would have known for decades that it was coming? They planned these things decades in advance. So they got a large proportion of our generation hooked on ecstasy when they did, and it altered their consciousness and their cognitive functions and all of this. So it would prevent many of them from rising up and taking action when it was most needed these past 2 or 3 years, because hasn't it been so disappointing seeing old ravers, grizzled old ravers, who used to be so anti-establishment, they went to these parties and it was like a big fuck you to the government, the man, and yet over the past 2 to 3 years, they've worn their masks, they've stayed at home, they've done everything they're told. It's just so disappointing. And I wonder whether, you know, the drugs were causing all the fight to be kicked out of them.
Yeah. Like a giant mass fluoridation.
Exactly.
That could be true as well, couldn't it? Very easily.
But again, behind the scenes of all this, what people, what ravers, and I've still got mates who go to Ibiza, and even at my age now, and still want to go out and dance the light fantastic every now and again. What they don't understand is that it's a military operation that was behind it all, a corporate military operation. And that's why they keep doing it. It's an addiction. They've made people addicted to certain elements of the life, haven't they? And like you say, pining for the nostalgia of it all.
I mean, we spoke about this in a previous podcast. When you wake up to what's really going on in this world, and if you turn your back on all the music and all the culture and maybe all the movies and things that you grew up on, what the hell is left for guys like us? What's left is research. We do research. That's how we plug that gap and fill that time. But if you're not a researcher and you realise that your youth was to a very large extent a lie, how do you plug that gap? What do you fill that with?
Yeah, well, what you used to fill it with was exactly the same, the stuff that you've put in the bottom drawer now and you don't want to listen to or watch anymore or read. What do you fill it with? Like I say, research, understanding what's been going on, opening those manhole covers and not being scared of what pops out, what smell comes out.
Thank God for research.
What I noticed, just a personal perspective here, actually me having been there instead of me talking about the 60s and not having been there. I do recall, I don't know if you guys recall this, the Caister Soul Weekend.
Oh yeah, Caister.
Yeah, it takes place in my hometown. And it has been taking place since, I think, the late 70s. And essentially when it began, it takes place in a holiday camp over a weekend. So essentially Soul fans could go to this event twice a year for a weekend, stay in chalets at the holiday camp, and there'd be like two or three rooms with DJs playing different variations of Soul. And you'd have the main room out of all those different rooms. There'd be the main room where the you know, with the biggest room where most of the action was taking place. Now, this went on from about I think it started in the late 70s.
Yeah, 79, Matt.
79. Now, what happened was, such was the popularity of acid house that by the time of 89-90, I think it was 1990 or 91, the Caister Soul Weekend was really suffering, because they realized that less and less people were coming to their events. There were less and less soul music fans coming to their event. Now, whether that was because a lot of the people that were into soul music that were coming from the late 70s were getting older, maybe that had something to do with it. But it could also be the fact that there were people who were a little bit younger that started to go to the Caister Soul Weekends for soul music a little bit after 79, so early 80s to mid 80s. So that generation, along with some of the older generation, might have started to get into house music. So whatever the reason, that the organizers of the Caister Soul Weekend realized in, and this is a huge, and you know, the Caister Soul Weekend is a huge national event. You know, this isn't just something that goes on in my part of the world in the East Coast of England. This is something that people from all over the country come to. It's a big deal. It's a big event in the soul music community, in the dance community. But what I noticed in 88, 89, and certainly in 1990, the the attendance was pretty low. So they had to switch their music policy and disregard soul music and bring in hardcore rave, hardcore house music. And I do recall going to one in 1990 and there was no soul music. God. Absolutely no soul music. It was just pure out and out house. And the soul music was actually demoted, if you like, to a smaller room. So it became like a side attraction. And in the main room where the main dance floor was and the stage was, where all the PAs and the live acts were appearing, that was all acid house and techno and hard house. We're talking 89, 90 here.
A lot of those old soul DJs, I mean, we were saying earlier that the likes of Pete Tong and Judge Jules and all that lot jumped on the dance music bandwagon, but there were many of that old sort of soul mafia crowd that hated house music. Chris Hill, you know, people like that. And I don't think Jeff Young was really into it. He played a bit of it on his Radio 1 show, but Jeff Young never went on the dance music bandwagon. So a lot of that old guard crowd hated what was happening, didn't they?
And I think there was a split in the case to Soul Weekend community and within the soul mafia, as they're called, the main soul DJs in the UK who have been pushing soul music since the 70s, who've championed it. They're called the Soul Mafia, aren't they? The Soul Mafia DJs, and Chris Hill is one of them. And yeah, there was a split. There was this debate going on back in the late 80s, early 90s, I think, if I'm not too mistaken, about, hey, what are we going to do here? You know, we're losing our soul audience to this new movement. I mean, I remember going to that Case to Soul Weekend, which was not a soul weekend, in 1990, I think it was. And it was Guru Josh was one of the main attractions. I mean, what? That is so far away from soul that you cannot imagine, you know.
Is it back to soul now, Matt? Is it still going?
It's back to soul now, yeah.
I've always wanted to go to a soul weekend. I've never been to one.
They're great. They're really good, yeah.
Yeah, that was the precursor to the Southport Weekender, wasn't it? Which is another big one.
And Prestatyn, that was another one, the Prestatyn Soul Weekender as well. Yeah, I can't speak for them, but certainly from Case to Soul Weekend, it did go through this dip. And I do know of other promoters within the town where I live who were very successful promoters in the 1980s that promoted soul music. There's a guy by the name of Richard who promoted these events called Richard's Parties, a very old friend of mine and sometime colleague of mine. And he used to promote these soul parties back in the early 80s. And he did. And one of the DJs he had on was, what's his name? Pete Tong. Pete Tong, when he was a soul DJ, he actually played at his parties. So he used to bring all these big DJs down to the South Coast, to the East Coast, to play at these Richard's parties, these one-off regular events. But I remember speaking to him in the late 80s into the early 90s, and he was going through troubles as well. He was finding that less and less people were going to his soul events, that just the numbers dwindled down from having been in the early 80s to mid 80s. He would have queues running down the street and people coming in coach loads, booking coaches to come down, coach parties. From that, in the late 80s, early 90s, to absolutely no one coming, or pretty much no one coming. So he had to revert to hardcore dance as well. He came to this point where he thought to himself, well, I've got to make a decision here. Do I stick with my main love, which is soul music, and die as a result and just give up my parties, or do I succumb to this new movement? And he chose the latter. He went with it. So I saw a lot of that going on. There was like this, there's a turning back on soul music, this exodus, if you like.
I used to go out when I used to go out clubbing with my friends, they were always shocked because when I got home, I just listened to soul music. As much as I liked. Another thing, actually, about when you were on about house, where did the worst house music come from? Because it's confusing that Chicago house, which I loved when we were growing up, and then it just switched to acid house. And I've always been, there's no similarity at all.
Supposedly named after the Warehouse nightclub in Chicago where Frankie Knuckles played.
Right, okay. I didn't know that.
I got its name.
Yeah. But another thing, just one more personal perspective I remember from back in the day. I mean, I used to love the music. I used to love acid music. And I admit I still like, I don't listen to it anymore, really. Not really. But I used to buy this stuff. I loved it. I played it because I was a DJ, but I loved it as well, you know. And I used to go to these events and get off on the music, like really, really sweat and dance for hours and hours and hours, right next to the speaker as well. People used to come up to me and say, God, what are you on? And I'd say nothing. I'd say, I'm not on anything. And they go, come. Oh, shut up. Of course you're on. Hey, listen, everyone. He says he's not on anything. But I wasn't.
Maybe that's why we're still capable of doing shows like this.
That's
the thing. Even back then, I used to question that and think, wait a minute. Do you have to be on something to appreciate music?
No.
Even then, I was starting to get this kind of twinging question in my head, this ringing question. Slightly faint little question ringing in the back of my mind, you know, but why do you need to take drugs to get off of music?
Yeah, there was something in the music that definitely affected people.
Yeah,
on a base level, on a different level, with or without drugs, I think.
So Matt, you brought up Pete Tong there, who's a guy from that Soul Mafia crowd who had no problem with jumping ship and getting on board this new house music scene, and he's been our man at the BBC for the past 30 odd years. He's had a show on there now since 1991. He's an MBE, as quite a few DJs are, unbelievably. David Rodigan, the reggae guy, is an MBE. Norman Jay is an MBE. Jazzy B is an MBE. Goldie's an MBE. Incredible, DJs getting gongs. And Pete Tong recently performed at the Coronation concert for King Sausage Fingers, you know, so he's very much in bed with the establishment. And Dom, you've got some stuff on one of the companies that Pete Tong has been selected to spearhead, which sort of further reinforces his role as a gatekeeper for the dance music scene, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't think we'll be going through all of this stuff, but some interesting stuff on his some of the businesses that he's actually involved with. He's involved in a company called Endeavour Group Holdings Incorporated, which interestingly had its roots in the William Morris Company, which is the biggest talent agency, or was the biggest talent agency in the world, going back to the late 1800s, where they were managing the early movie stars and early recordings of the phonograph type music, all the way up to present day, where they sort of so they set a separate company up, which was about modern dance music DJs. So they sort their gigs out and manage the, so you can't get a gig without them, basically.
It's a bit like the Copeland family. When you get into researching the punk and new wave scene, Stuart Copeland's dad, out of the Police, was a CIA guy. And the Police, the clue is in the name, because they were there to police all the other bands. They were like the gatekeepers for that whole scene. And you couldn't get gigs and you couldn't be a successful band unless the Copelands co-signed you. So it's the same sort of dynamic going on here.
Well, it's interesting that the founder of Endeavour, who merged with this William Morris agency, his father was a Zionist, and it keeps going back around this. They're either Zionists, eugenicists, or some kind of bloodline, or all three mixed together every time you do that. And he was part of a paramilitary organization, as you can see in my notes here. And they were best known for bombing King David Hotel in Jerusalem and killing 107 Palestinians. So these are the people that I found that he's sort of working for. But they're owned by, I know they say they've got to follow the money, but they're owned by massive organisations, this company. One of them called Silver Lake, which is a private investment company that own all these companies you can see now on the screen. The Ancestry.com, again, you don't need to, which owns the data and genetics on a lot of people, because they've all been doing, they own Dell. I'm flicking through Expedia, et cetera, et cetera. But they're a massive organisation. You can see the ownership of Endeavour. So Tong's set up now. He's fully corporate, I would say. Now he's set up with these guys. You can see Vanguard own part of this company, GIC. All of these companies, the top six down to Morgan Stanley, are all World Economic Forum partners. And going back to what you were saying in an email, Mark, about is IMS, are all pushing the agenda.
Yeah, the International Music Summit in Ibiza, he founded that as well.
Yeah, this is why these people are pushing agendas, because they're all funded, you know, all these companies that own the company that he works for or has shares in are World Economic Forum partners.
I forgot to mention earlier with regards to the WEF, when I mentioned the Bolloré family, I still don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but anyway, whatever. Bolloré family, who own UMG through Vivendi. One of Vincent's sons, he's like the head guy. His sons, who are his basically his heirs. One of them a few years back was one of the WEF's young leaders, was chosen as one of their young leaders.
The World Economic Forum Young Leaders of Tomorrow.
Yeah. So the United Music Group's future is secured under the umbrella of the
otherwise WEF. Known as the Nazi Youth.
And that IMS summit that Tong sort of co-runs in Ibiza has been pushing globalist agendas in recent times. I look at their schedule each year and it's like, you know, diversity in music and how to be inclusive to the LGBTQ community in dance music and getting through hard times in COVID. How does the industry recover? That sort of thing. So, you know, it's propping up the official version of everything. And it raises the question of whether Tong is someone that was earmarked from very early days to be an asset with all these agendas, or whether he's shown himself to be someone who's willing to be down with whatever's offered to him, and he will do anything for fame and success. I suppose that's a question we'll never be able to answer.
I never found him authentic, personally, when I listened to him in the 90s on BBC.
Say even as a youngster, I always thought he was like a vanilla version of DJs, if you know what I mean. It's interesting, isn't it? There are all these people as well, like you were just saying. Even the 60s ones and the modern day, the 80s, 90s ones, they start off from a culture that literally revolves around drugs, and then they all end up SIRS and OBEs and stuff.
Pushing arm spears.
Yeah, pushing, yeah. They're involved in an illegal movement, and then they get knighted. How does that work?
Well, yeah, exactly. Mick Jagger, there's another one.
McCartney, yeah. Jagger, every single one of them.
And well, ironically, Pete Tong's a recruitment agent, isn't he? He was an A&R man. That's how he started.
Yeah, FFRR London Records. He signed a whole load of acts. I think early days he signed Salt and Pepper. He signed Satoshi Tomy, Tears, that one. The Joe Smooth, Promised Land, Sterling Void. They were all FFRR records that Tong signed up.
I remember having those FFRR records, actually.
Yeah, me too. Lil Louis, French Kiss, yeah, that was another FFRR one. I might be wrong, again, because I don't have my notes on this, but FFRR, I think, is a subsidiary of Decca Records.
That's right.
And the reason they came up with FFRR is because it's loosely based on a type of technology that was used in radar by Decca Records.
I was going to ask you, Matt, is that the
it's
way...
frequency where... something, isn't it?
Full frequency range recordings.
Yeah.
Is that where the word Dex comes from the Decca Records?
No.
Where does the word Dex come from?
I don't know. That's a good question.
It doesn't really balance with anything to do with a pair of musicals.
No, it doesn't. No, I don't know. I honestly don't know.
I just thought when you were on about Decca Records earlier, is that where the word Dex came from?
I mean, there is an interesting history to record Dex and Twin Turntable.
Yeah, I saw your pictures about that. Yeah,
labels that has a military background to it.
Shock and horror.
If you want me to mention that, yeah, shock and horror. Exactly.
I thought that was really interesting. The vocoder thing.
Yeah. The vocoder. Yeah. I mean, I might be wrong, Mark. You might be able to correct me on this. But from what I understand, what a vocoder is it makes your voice sound robotic. You can hear it on various tracks over the decades. It's been used in music since about the 70s.
It's a precursor to autotune, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a precursor to autotune.
Roger Troutman from Zap.
Yeah, that's right.
I've seen footage of it being used. There's footage of Stevie Wonder using it. And if I'm not wrong, how you use it in a live context, maybe in a studio context, you don't need to do this, but in a live context, I mean, in order to make yourself sound like this robot, because that's what it sounds like to me, it sounds like a robot voice, is you have like this plastic clear tube and you connect it to, say, a keyboard like Stevie Wonder has in this video. You connect it to the keyboard and on the other end you put your mouth into it and you speak or sing into the tube, and while you play the keys of the keyboard, it corresponds with the tube and feeds it through the tube, so it comes out in your voice as a robot, and you can change the keys of your voice with the keyboard. So if you go to an A, your voice will go A or G or F or whatever, but it will sound like a robot. Got a list of vocoder led tracks here. Earth, Wind and Fire, Let's Groove, the that's a vocoder apparently. Neil Young recorded a track in 1981, or an album I think, called Trans, which was completely vocoder, or at least one or two tracks on it were vocoder. Herbie Hancock, the Mr. Sunlight album, title track, of course, one of his most famous tracks. ELO, Mr. Blue Sky, Mr. Blue Sky. Yeah. Michael Jackson, PYT. You know the bit in the middle with a PYT.
Is the Stevie Wonder one Saturn? Is it
Stevie Wonder one? Is actually Saturn. Him on Sesame Street. Right. You can find it on YouTube. It's him doing a Sesame Street theme. And I think he's riffing it. He's improvising it a little bit, but he's doing it through a vocoder.
Because on Songs of, on his album,
Songs in the Key of Life.
Songs in the Key of Life. Saturn sounds like one, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Saturn. Yeah, yeah. I think Pink Floyd as well did it on the Animals album.
That famous Peter Frampton tune. What's it called? Was it on that one as well?
Oh, yeah. Because some of them aren't vocoders that you think might be vocoders, aren't vocoders. They're another kind of, they're a different kind of technology. But Africa Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force, Planet Rock, apparently that's vocoder as well. Daft Punk have used it, Phil Collins, Madonna. But anyway, the thing with this vocoder is it actually dates back to the late 1920s or early 30s, depending on whose version of history you want to believe. And it was invented by a guy called Homer Dudley, and he invented it for the telecommunications and technological company Bell Labs. And apparently when they invented it, so the official narrative states, it was meant to be used as a speech compressor. It's basically vocoder stands, it's a shortened version of the word voice coder, because it handles someone's speech in a coded form. Okay, so basically what they wanted to do back in the 1930s, when overseas telecommunications was in its infancy, basically what Bell Labs was looking to manufacture, to produce, to invent, if you like, was a form of overseas telecommunications, underwater cables that could be used through underwater cables under the sea, that would be cheap on bandwidth. And the way that they figured they could do this was by speech compression. So this is where the vocoder came in. It was used, they were hoping to use it, basically the idea was it was to break the voice down and transmit only the necessary frequencies. So that's what they were hoping to do, but it didn't really work out. It just didn't work, so it got pushed to the sidelines. And then what happened was, fast forward to the 1940s during the Second World War, Britain and the US were looking for ways of using communications without getting intercepted by the Germans. Telephone communications were a little bit dicey, apparently. They were looking for ways, like, for example, Winston Churchill, then Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and then President Theodore Roosevelt, were looking for ways to chat on the phone without being intercepted by the enemy. So, and they tried various means of, you know, like they had the A3 scrambler, which apparently they used, but that wasn't very very reliable. So in pops the vocoder. In 1942, apparently the US Army, with backing from London, awarded Bell Labs initially to build two vocoder-driven voice security systems. And they were given the name, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, Sigsaly, Sigsaly. I don't know if that is an acronym, I don't know, but that's what it's called. It was called Sigsaly. So two of these were initially built to be used in communications between Britain and London initially. But what happened during the war was another 12 were built, or in total 12 of them were built. And they were established across the world. So you had one at the Pentagon in Washington, you had one in Paris, you had one in London, Manila. I think there was one in Australia as well, if I'm not too mistaken. Now, this was a huge piece of kit. This was something like, it measured about 2,500 square feet. Absolutely huge. And part of this massive, huge piece of kit were a pair of, it was a twin turntables. Twin turntables were part of this piece of kit. Now, I published an article about this a few years back, about 2-3 years back. Now, I'm not very technically minded. I think you'll probably find, Mark, I don't know if I'm wrong, might be wrong, but a lot of DJs aren't technically minded. You'd think they are, but...
Well, I'm certainly not.
Yeah, exactly. When equipment breaks down in a club and the speakers go, the DJ is the last person you want to ask how to fix it, because they will not know. They just want to play the music. I'll shut up with all that boring technical stuff. Just get the music back on, you know. So what I've done here is I've had to, in 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 preparation for our chat today, I knew we were gonna, I had an idea we might talk about this. So I printed out a piece from my article that I composed on Conspiromedia about 2 or 3 years ago about the vocoder and about this Sig Sailey.
Just something interesting, Matt, just before you go into your thing. Yeah. Bell Systems were part of Bell Telecom, which is part of AT&T, that was part of Alexander Graham Bell, who was a eugenicist, who was a dark occultist, who was part of Graham Shelby Downard's book on Jekyll Island when he was in Masonic sex rituals.
Bell Technologies.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we've mentioned Huxley. Let's just throw in that Julian and Aldous were both supporters of eugenics as well. I don't know.
Well,
if
Sir Julian Huxley was the president of the British Eugenics Society.
Indeed. Indeed, he was.
And Alexander Graham Bell was the honorary president of the Second International Eugenics Congress in 1921.
Okay. So I do have photographs
of interesting
of these
people behind all these systems.
I know. It just goes on and on and on. It's like spider's web, isn't it? Now, I do have photographs that I can send on to you guys that we can show in the video of the twin turntables, these military turntables. Okay, so I'm reading here bits from my article because I'm not technically minded and this is technical information and I don't want to get it wrong and I know I'll get it wrong, so I'm just going to read a little bit from my article. So, and I quote, according to the Science Museum of London's official website, Sig Sailey was introduced in 1943 for scrambling the highest levels of secure communication. Sig Sailey worked by first digitizing the speech signal and then encrypting the signal by adding a digitized random noise signal, which acted as a key. For Sig Sailey, this key that was used for encryption was a one-time key, meaning that it was at least as long as the message. Now, the phonograph record, the records that were on the twin turntables, stored the random noise that was generated using electronic waves. Each record was duplicated, one for each end of the conversation. So by each end of the conversation, what they mean by that, I think, is so you'd have the station with this Sig Sailey system in, say, Washington at the Pentagon wanting to communicate with Manila. So you would use, so that's what they mean by communicating with each other. It's Washington communicating with Manila, or the other way around, Manila wanting to communicate with Washington. So you've got this phonograph record, okay, that stored this random noise that was generated using electronic waves. Each record was duplicated, one for each end of the conversation, and was capable of holding 12 minutes of noise or key information. And this is where the twin decks came into their own. And I've got a quote here, which is attributed to a Lieutenant Donald Mell. And he claims he worked on these Sig Sailey systems back in it during the war. And he says, and I quote, the two turntables at the transmitting end and the two turntables at the receiving end would operate continuously. Okay. And after 12 minutes, it would automatically switch over to the other turntable. So you had all the turntables working. Okay. So after 12 minutes, it would automatically switch over to the other turntable. So when we started a turntable in Manila, it had to be synchronized with the one in Washington, D.C., 10,000 miles away. We had to be on point. If the needle jumped the groove, you hear garble because you no longer had the key in synchronization. So basically what they were doing was they were synchronizing records on twin decks. This is the precursor of beat mixing without beats. And I just find that pretty mind-blowing.
And more military applications as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Endless.
Just reading here, Matt, that it said that the first Sig Sailey machine was set up at the Pentagon and the second in the basement of Selfridge's department store in Oxford Street.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
They look just like a pair of decks, don't they, Matt? Like
you said, they do. And I know twin decks have been around before then. I think I've looked around and I've seen photographs of twin decks dating back to the 1920s. But what makes this different? Because someone watching and listening to this now might think, oh, what's so special about that? You could get twin decks in the 20s. But what makes these different is the twin decks in the 20s didn't synchronize records. They weren't, you know, but these decks are synchronizing records. So when was the first beat mixing? Apparently the first DJs to start beat mixing on twin decks was in the late 60s.
Well, you know, he was credited with being the first DJ in the UK to play gramophone records in dance halls using turntables, right?
Jimmy Savile.
That's Sir Jimmy to you.
How's about that then? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of beat mixing, apparently the art of beat mixing started in the late 60s from what I can gather. But so the military were using twin decks to basically synchronize records during the World War. Wow.
Connections for days. Any last thoughts to add as we close off the 80s? Because we'll pick up the next show in the early 90s. But anything to bookend that decade of the 80s just before we go?
Well, I think the Summer of Love was the go button, wasn't it? Because the 90s was really full-on clubbing scene, wasn't it? It hit the pop charts. It seemed every other song was a dance song in the charts at one point. It was either them or Blur or Oasis. The super clubs then arose out of this in the late 90s. And I remember Chuff Chuff coming out of Miss Money Pennies. And all these, I went to a couple of Chuff Chuffs in private, like massive mansions or big hotels as they were in Buxton, one of them actually. I know Buxton held, I didn't realise this, Buxton held one of the Bilderberger meetings in the hotel that the rave was in. Exactly, in the 50s. You can't make this stuff up if you wanted to. And then one of the big ones was in Harrogate as well, in a hotel there. So, yeah, the super clubs were a big thing. That's when it went full on corporate. And at the end of the 90s, when the DJs then got the big money for the millennium, that altered everything, I think. That changed another direction then.
And then when DJs started to support bands at stadiums, you know, U2, DJ sets from U2, you know, DJ sets at U2 concerts by big name DJs.
Oakenfold and the like.
Yeah, I think Paul McCartney uses, certainly, it's not a thing. I know Paul McCartney uses a DJ as his warm up.
So, as we were saying earlier, the second Summer of Love, so-called, was actually two summers. It was 88 and 89. And the music of those 2 years was very different. So, in 88, it was all that burbling synth sort of stuff, the acid sound as we know it. But in 89, you had songs like, or tracks like, Pacific State, 808 State, and The Sun Rising, Beloved. And a lot of these songs had, like, bird noises and nature noises, and it was much more spiritual than 88 had been. And it was as if they were getting ready to close off that decade, ready for what they knew was coming in the 90s. And Chris, you mentioned earlier that they like to do things by the decades, and Crow 777 and Jason have done some great shows lately looking at these different decades, how they seem to have a certain culture that they would push in, like the 1970s. And by the time you get to 79, they're ready to close that off and bring in some different aspects for the 80s, and they do it by the decades, because 1990 was very different to 1989. It was paving the way for that whole decade. So the major changes, I would say, took place during the 90s. So 87, 88, 89 were in preparation for all of that.
You're quite excited to discuss, like you said, the 90s stuff, because that's what I was more involved in. Not even for that long, really, when I think about it now. It's only for a couple of years, really. But the super clubs like Cream, I think there was Wigan Pier was one, wasn't it, Dom, up there?
They did one at Wigan.
That's closed down now, actually. Guess what's there now?
Primark.
Orwell's Pub, Bar and Restaurant, I think it is.
Oh, that's interesting. Gatecrasher, that's another one.
Gatecrasher, that was another one.
Yep. Yeah, Gatecrashers.
Judge Jules there.
Judge Jules. And do you know, a lot of the big name DJs, I wasn't really ever that impressed with them when I went to see them, being blunt. I always found the local DJs always played better music.
Yeah, we used to go to a place in Huddersfield called KU Club. And I think some quite famous DJs came out.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Yeah, it was good. It was a proper scene, that was.
You'll have to dig out some of your... Chris, a friend of ours did a club in Hull, and Chris used to do the flyers for it.
They used to do the artwork for it, yeah.
Back in the early 90s.
It was called Kick, yeah. And I was living in London at the time. We used to do all the artwork and flyers and then post them up to him.
We'll have to get into Carl Cox on the next show.
He was the pusher of the arm spears.
Yep.
Just got to get back on with our lives and take these jabs.
Yeah, Mr. C was the other one, was another one.
Well, we know what the C stands for now, don't we?
Yeah.
All right then. Well, we've pissed off a few grizzled old ravers from back in the day with this show, so mission fulfilled.
But do you know, there was some good music out there, and there were some talented people. 100%. You know, I enjoyed my time going clubbing. I enjoyed the music. We had a little recording studio. Me and some of my friends. I used to write songs. Used to do a bit of singing. I preferred writing. We was actually one of the my mates is a guy Paul who was in the band Shiva. I think you and Mark were talking about them. He did most of the writing and the music for that.
There is a video on YouTube of Dom singing, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, that was Louise Dean, wasn't it? Got run over.
That's right. Yeah, on Manchester Road, and just so there was a lot. We're talking about the good side and the control, but there's a very dark element to all this. A lot of people really fell off the side of a cliff. Some of them started getting into heavy drugs and what have you. So there is a dark side to this. Some are major psychological problems and things like that, paranoia and what have you. And so it wasn't all sweetness and light for everybody.
But again, same like the 60s fight, as much as you have people saying, oh, the 60s were great and blah, blah, there's also that grizzled acid screwed guy who can't string a sentence together, you know. So
and like the 60s, Chris, the Ultiman concert that the Rolling Stones did, there was a dark side to that part, and I think the grunge coming into grunge, that was the dark side to the dance music, because that element took over as well. So you had the dark and the light again, didn't you?
And they've killed the smiley face off with a dint inside of his head and some crosses on his eyes, and his tongue hanging out for Nirvana, like we said.
Well, there's plenty there to get into for next time, but we'll leave it there for today. So thanks for coming on, guys. What a great show.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
It's been great. It's good to talk about stuff you're really interested in, isn't it?
Well, that you lived through.
I know, it is. What else are we going to do with our lives?
Yeah. Well, we've screwed up films, books and everything for me. That was good for me, yeah. Musical taste.
That would actually be an interesting one, that, Chris. Looking at some of the films that were around at that particular moment in time.
That's your homework for next time around, Chris.
That would be an interesting one.
All right, guys. Cheers. See you next time. Thanks for listening to episode 2. There's 2 more episodes in this series to go, and in the next one, we're taking it into the 90s and considering what that early acid house scene paved the way for, and the lasting legacy of that culture that's still with us to this day. We'll see you for episode 3.